Okay, you'll notice on your schedule that it says two maestros. And I explain why I chose that term every year. I like the word maestro. And where I saw it was in a movie from Argentina called Tango. And down there, the tango is top tango dancers like our star quarterback here. And there's a scene in the nightclub where they interrupt all the music and the owner of the club announces that they have a maestro there to demonstrate the tango. And the Argentine tango is a very complicated dance. It takes a lifetime to really learn it. And he makes it look effortless. He makes it look so simple. And after you've been around AA for a while, you find that you do reduce life to its simplest terms. And our two guests tonight who volunteered to share for 25 minutes each, to me, capture this. Just the simplicity of the energy in living and presenting the message. And the first one is a gentleman I've known for 25 years up in Washington, D.C. We're fellow Marines. And he's been a delight. I was there at his first meeting, and he's been a delight to watch. I just love what's happened to him, and he agreed to share whatever comes out this evening, and let's welcome Bill Peterson from Washington, D.C.
Maestro is an ancient Anglo-Saxon word for bullshitter. My name is Bill Peterson. I'm an alcoholic. Sandy and I, the Marine Corps in its wisdom sent Sandy and me to Japan sometime after the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was stationed down south. I was stationed up north. We never met. Good thing. They'd have buried my remains at the foot of Mount Fuji if we had met. Or perhaps more appropriately, scattered my ashes over the Tiger Bar in Yokohama. I'll just say this. When I hit Japan in the Marine Corps, my alcoholism went into double afterburner. Boom, boom. And when I left in 64, it kept going for another 22 years until I flamed out. I live in Washington, D.C. I'm CIA. Catholic Irish alcoholic. Now, I've been making my living as a news broadcaster for over 40 years, and I can bullshit on almost anything. But I don't know much about spirituality, and I don't want to bullshit on that. I'm just going to tell you my experience, and you just take it for what it is. I saw a book the other day by Kerry Kennedy. It's a series of little personal profiles called Catholics Now. And people talk about their Catholic youth and so forth. And I thought it was kind of interesting. And I was, you know, obviously they answered a set of questions. And I thought if somebody had asked me to do that, you know, where would I begin? And I tried to go back and I realized something. I couldn't remember my first communion. And in the Catholic tradition, this is very important, First Communion. It begins at the age of 7, supposedly the age of reason, where you know right from wrong. And the little boys dress up in white suits and white shirts and white ties, and little girls dress up like little brides, and everybody celebrates, and it's a big thing. But I can't remember it. I have no memory of it at all. What I do remember is my first confession. I remember that. I remember that very clearly. You go into this dark place behind a heavy velvet curtain. Slide opens, and a voice says, "Yes, begin." And you say, "Bless me, Father, for I've sinned." And he says, "How long since your last confession?" I said, "This is my first confession, Father." He said, and what are your sins?" I said, "I committed adultery 7 times. He said, "You what?" "I committed adultery 7 times. He said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 7, Father." He said, "Adultery is a grown-up sin." All right, let me help you. We sin in thought, word, or deed. Was this thought, word, or deed? Word, Father. Well, tell me about it. Well, I don't think I should. Tell me about it. Well, I called Freddie Farkas a shithead 7 times. And he said, "Well, you know, that's a vulgarity. That's not, but you shouldn't be saying bad things about Freddie." "Why are you saying bad things?" I said, "Because he beats me up all the time." He said, "Well, it's not really, you know, you're okay. And we went through other things. Did you disobey your parents? Were you disrespectful and so forth? Say 3 Our Fathers, 3 Hail Marys, a good act of contrition." And then you have to get a running start on these prayers or you flame out in the middle. And so that was it. But the interesting thing about this, I don't remember my first communion is supposed to be your first conscious contact with your higher power, with your God. And I don't remember that. I remember the separation. I remember the sin part, but I don't remember the communion part. It's interesting. And when I was a kid, I hated alcohol. I hated what it did to people. And I always said to myself, "I'm never going to do this to myself. No child of mine is ever going to witness this kind of behavior." And I kept that promise. I mean, I didn't drink in high school, and I didn't drink through the freshman year of college. And I had a lot of friends. And I was popular. I was elected class office year after year after year. And I felt totally alone, isolated. Felt like I didn't fit in. My parts didn't mesh with other people's parts, despite all the friends and all the popularity. I felt a sort of anxiety all the time. There was a little guy in my gut with sharp knives who was kind of grinding away all the time. So I never discussed this with anybody because I never let anybody get close enough to me to hear this. And anyway, as I say, I didn't drink through my freshman year of college. And then I decided, Sandy mentioned religious orders. I joined one after my freshman year of college, an ancient one, founded in the early 13th century, semi-cloistered, monastic order. They call themselves friars. And they had a lot of rules, and I didn't agree with any of the rules. I didn't take any vows, but they work you toward vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. I didn't have any problem with poverty because I was a child of the Depression and nobody had any money anyway. Obedience was a real problem for me. There were things they wanted me to do and I just didn't want to do them. They didn't want us to smoke. I smoked. I managed to find cigarettes. The novice master and I didn't get along. I thought he was a very unreasonable guy. They wanted me to change. They wanted me to change. And I didn't want to change. I liked the way I was. Just the way it was. I thought it was fine. I thought they were screwed up. I thought they were yesterday's men. Chastity? Well, I didn't agree with the dating policy, okay? These monks in these ancient orders, they face each other in these priories or monasteries, and then the altar is up here. And out here, the faithful come when they come to Mass. And on Sundays, the local sheriff would bring his daughters in. And the daughters were built like brick cathedrals. And I started to notice on Sundays I was more focused on the sheriff's daughters than I was on what was going on the altar. And I thought, this is telling me something. So I decided this life isn't for me. But I will say I did start to drink in there, and I figured if anybody's got a right to drink, it's a guy like me in a place like this who is so misunderstood. So that's where I started drinking. because I was being misunderstood. And they were free to change. So I left, I finished college, and then I enlisted in the Marine Corps. And then they started telling me what to do. And I, quite frankly, I didn't like taking orders there either. But in the monastery, if you don't take orders, they just give you some penance or something. In the Marine Corps, if you don't take orders, they lock your ass up. So, you know, I had to live with it. But I started drinking, and it got, as I said earlier, it got pretty serious. I got out, and I managed to get out without any disciplinary proceedings, miraculously. And I decided I wanted to be a broadcast journalist. I had no training, I had no schooling, I had no experience, and I bullshit my way into that job, which I've been doing ever since. And I've never had a real job. I was 71 last Friday, and the way I'm going, it looks like I'll never have to have one. So I'm still doing the same thing. When alcoholism is your master, you don't do the job you could probably do to the best of your ability. I got married, not a good husband, had two beautiful children whom I love more than anything on the face of the earth, but it didn't keep me away from a drink, my feelings for them. By the way, I want to go back to this early religious training. I never felt connected. I really never felt connected to a higher power or to God or anything like that, except once, I remember. My father was in a lot of trouble. I love my father. Of course, I never let him know that, because I never let anybody know how I felt about him. After he died, I remember I went into the bathroom, cried hot tears, looked in the mirror and said, "You never told him how much you love him." That was my life. But he was in some trouble. And so I started going to Mass and communion every day for, I don't know, a couple of months. And I did. I felt I was praying for him. I was asking God to take care of him. And I felt a connection there, you know. And then things worked out for him. That's it. I stopped going. And the connection disappeared. In any case, I got married. Situation was not good. I was a bad husband, not a good father. Bad employee, but I got away with it. And then one night in February, in the 80s, I had a short, intense, inspirational conversation with a policeman from Montgomery County, Maryland. And he was in a driving snowstorm. And I grew up in New England. I love to drive in snow. But the guy pulled me over and we started all this stuff. And I said, what did you pull me over for? He said, well, you were going like this. I said, look out there. Everybody's going like that. There are ruts in the snow. And he said, where do you live? I said, right over there. That's the roof of my house, right over there. He said, get in the house and stay there till morning. I said, you know, I really like cops. I don't think you get the respect you deserve. I think you get a bad. He said, never mind the bullshit. Just get in the car and don't come out till you see blue sky and sunshine. So I went to the house and talked to my then wife, and she had been going to out to a treatment center for a couple of years, telling everybody what a great husband she had. And I said, I think I ought to go talk to that guy you've been talking to. So I went out there the next morning, got all dressed up, blue suit, white shirt, tie, shine shoes. And the place was run by a psychiatrist, MD, and a recovering alcoholic, former Navy guy. And the MD breathalyzed me. He said, when did you have your last drink? I said, I don't know, about 6 o'clock last night. It's now about noontime. He said, that's 18 hours. I said, yeah. He said, you've got enough. The alcohol in your system right now is life-threatening. Right now, 18 hours after your last drink. And I had this great feeling of pride and elation. I said, all right. You got a real man now, all right? Yeah? So I figured I'd stick around and listen to these guys until I heard some lies. It was an 18-month program. I stayed for 22 months. I'd been there, I don't know, a week, and I got a call from a reporter friend of mine. He said, I understand you're undergoing treatment for alcoholism. Good luck to you. I said, where'd you hear that? She said, from so-and-so. It's another person in the program, same place. They have signs all over the place respecting your anonymity and all that. So I got very upset, very upset. They said, I hope you're not going to leave because of this. Well, I'm very upset. So I started complaining about it in one of the group therapy sessions. During a break, this very nice young woman came up to me and she said, "I don't know who you are. To me, you're just another fucking drunk." And that's when I learned that God used the F word, because that's all I am. When I told you I'm an alcoholic, we were strangers yesterday, but you know me today better than 90% of the people who've known me my whole life. As soon as I say that to you, you know who I am. And when I hear you say that, I know who you are. I've got your number and you got my number. So I decide, well, I better get into AA. So I call this woman I knew who was in recovery, and she said, "I got a good meeting for you. It's over at Sibley Hospital in Washington, D.C. And as a Marine like you running the thing, and I think you'll like it." So I go in, and the place is packed. And I sit next to this very elegant woman, and this Marine fighter pilot is up there. Sandy B is his name. And he's raffling off potted mums. This is how he starts. He's raffling out pot. So the woman next to me said, "I used to be one of those." I said, "One of what?" She said, "A potted mum." Jesus. All right, that's okay. So he starts to talk, and I'm thinking, he's been talking to the guys out at the treatment center. He knows about me. He's got my number. He's talking about my life. I listen, and at the end of the meeting, we all hold hands, we say the Lord's Prayer. I find myself weeping. And I realize I'm a guy who never felt he belonged anywhere, never felt at home. For the first time in my life, I feel at home. I feel like I belong somewhere. In the past, whenever I'm somewhere, I want to be somewhere else. I'm in this room, and I think, this is right where I belong. I'm at home at last. That's a staggering thought. So I walk out, and I'm suddenly surrounded by thugs. Bunch of guys. I don't know who the hell they are. Said, "Tuesday morning up at the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, in room such and such, there's a meeting. It's called the Yays and Nays. Be there. It starts at 8 or 8:15. I said, "I can't. I work nights." Guy said, "Do you have an alarm clock?" I said, "Yeah, I have an alarm." "You set the alarm." I said, "Look, when you're going to bed, I'm going to work, 11 p.m. He said, "You have a bed?" I said, "Yeah, I have a bed." "Let's take a nap." So these were not suggestions. These were demands. So I went up there, and I'm walking up there. It's a beautiful day, and I noticed for the first time ever, I see this beautiful Capitol Dome in focus. And I thought, this is a plus. I walk through the door. A guy comes up, and he says, "Hi, my name is Bob. What's yours?" I said, "My name is Bill." He said, "How much time do you have, Bill?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "How long have you been sober? How long since you had your last drink?" I said, "I don't know, I guess 2 weeks." He said, "Congratulations. You've got more sobriety than 99% of the alcoholics in the world." So I sit down, and, you know, the meeting's going. I introduce myself to the guy next to me. He looks like a bulldog. His name's Jeremiah. Like this. In the middle of the meeting, he says, "Willie, bullshit's all right unless you believe your own." Every time I went up there for a month, that's what he said to me. He knew something about me. And so I kept coming back, and every time I come back, I bump into Bob. The week later, Bob says, "Congratulations, Bill, you got 21 days. Week after that, "Congratulations, Bill, you got 28 days. This goes on and on. And after 6 months, he hands me this little blue chip from East Moline, Illinois, and it says 6 months on it. And he kept giving me these chips. And suddenly other people started giving me these chips. And I began to get it. And I'd been about 4 months since I'd had a drink. And I was at the Saturday morning live meeting, Sandy's meeting. And I see a guy I used to work with. And he doesn't look good. He's got 3 days' growth of beard. And he's got food all over his T-shirt. And I start to speak to him. He's out of focus. And I noticed after the meeting, he jumps on this little white bus. So I say to somebody, "What's the white bus?" So that's the PI bus, Psychiatric Institute bus. It's a treatment place down on K Street in Washington. It was like a prison. Sandy used to go down there every Wednesday and run a meeting. I knew that. So I jump on the bus and I say, hey, I'll see you Wednesday night. The bus driver said, "I'll tell him. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing right now." Well, by the time I get down there Wednesday, he was all cleaned up and he looked pretty good. And he have a sponsor. How about being my sponsor? I said, you're out of your mind. I said, I got 4 months. I'm a rookie. And there was one of the guys who worked there was walking by, and he said, say yes. So I run over to Sandy, and I say, this guy wants me to sponsor him. I barely read the big book. He says, I'll help you with it. So I start to sponsor. Well, we sponsor each other, basically, and we've been doing it ever since. Here's how this thing works. I get a call. This is a guy who traveled a lot. I get a call from the Philippines. He says, I'm in real trouble. What do you mean? He says, I'm in my room in this 5-star hotel, and there's a bar in the room. There's every kind of liquor you can think of, and I can't stop looking at it. Now, there's like 13 hours difference, so, you know, these calls are taking place at weird times. So I said, go in the bathroom, get a towel, put it over the booze. So he calls me back about an hour later. He says, it's not working. I keep thinking what's under the towel. So I said, go for a walk. He calls me back. I went for the walk, but is this? I can't. So I said, take a cold shower. So he gets I still keep thinking what's under the towel. I said, go for another walk. He goes for another walk. He said, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. I'll keep walking all night. I'll call you back. He called me back about an hour later. He said, I figured it out. I said, what'd you do? He said, I called the front desk. I told him to take the booze out of the room. This is over about a 6-hour period. So this guy and I are like two drunks trying to get across the street, right? For over 2 decades. That's how we're living our lives, you know. So that part of it works. But my marriage, it was breaking up, and it was rough, and just rough. And I had this noise in my head, and I couldn't get the noise out of my head, and it was just awful. And I was going to meetings, and I was talking to Sandy, and I was guilty about my kids. And every day he would say to me, hey, before you hang up, I got a message for you. You're a great father. Every night.